New Hampshire Public Radio News. It's now 9:06.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Today it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and here are some of the voices from the week's top news stories.
This bipartisan bill that I'll be signing in a couple of minutes is the most significant state-level investment in our infrastructure in 23 years.
A very good step to get this behind us. We've been having people calling and threatening or actually canceling vacation plans and threatening to boycott Wolfboro businesses and all this kind of thing.
Today I sit here dumbfounded and disappointed that the actions seemingly taken by a few rogue individuals has tainted the good work that so many people have done on behalf of the state of New Jersey.
It's not a free pass to get out of changing and growing. No, it's just that when you are free from self-doubt, you fail better because you don't have your defenses up and you can accept criticism and listen. You don't become so preoccupied with that failure either that you forget how to learn and how to grow. When you believe in yourself, you succeed better.
To truly honor his life and learn from his death, I believe we all need to go back to our departments in our own lives and continue what he started and live up to the standards Officer Steve Arkell has set as a police officer, father, and member of his community.
From the top, that was Governor Maggie Hassan on the signing of a transportation funding bill that includes the state's first gas tax increase in over 20 years. David Owen, town manager of Wolfboro, on the resignation this week of town police commissioner Robert Copeland after a racist comment caused a national stir. Matt Mowers, executive director of the New Hampshire Republican Party, testifying before a special committee on the so-called Bridgegate scandal in New Jersey. Academy Award-winning writer Jennifer Lee giving the commencement address at her alma mater, the University of New Hampshire. And Colonel Robert Quinn of the New Hampshire State Police speaking during a tribute for fallen Brentwood police officer Stephen Arkell. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today on The Exchange. Let us hear from you as we examine these and other headlines, including a new federal disaster relief request for April flooding in the North Country. To join our conversation, you can call into The Exchange at 1-800-892-6477. You can send us an email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can post a comment on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange, all one word. And our guests for this week's Roundup are Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, welcome back to the Roundup.
Thanks for inviting me, Dean.
Norma Love, senior State House reporter for the Associated Press.
Good morning.
Hi, Norma. It's always good to have you with us here. And Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader and the New Hampshire Sunday News. Gary, good to have you back as well.
Thank you, Dean.
And also joining us for the first portion of our show is NHPR reporter Michael Brindley. Michael, thanks for sitting in with us.
Good morning.
As always, we have a lot to talk about, so let's get right to it. As we heard in the montage of voices, this week, members of law enforcement and private citizens alike paused to remember Brentwood police officer Stephen Arkell, who was killed in the line of duty. Michael, can you talk a little bit about what we saw take place this week?
Yeah, last week was really about kind of the news of what happened. This week was really about just kind of paying tribute to Steve Arkell, who he was to that community. I was down there a few times this week. The service was Wednesday. It was just a powerful day for the community, a day of remembrance. The procession was something to see. Just thousands, countless officers from all over New England. You try to keep track of the badges you saw, and it was just everywhere. Small towns, big cities, everywhere representing, coming here to pay tribute to Steve Arkell. And I think the speakers all did a great job of just kind of encapsulating his life, what he meant to that community, both Brentwood and Exeter. He was a coach, a varsity lacrosse coach at Exeter High School, and actually the ceremony took place at the field where he coached his two daughters on the team. So just a really powerful day for that community, I think a day of closure for them to move forward.
And it seemed almost as though I think there were really, in reality, sort of 3 days of activity, starting on Tuesday, I think, with a special walkthrough for officers. Is that right? And then it continued on, as you mentioned, Wednesday, and then also, I think, on Thursday as well.
Yeah, there were two wakes, actually. actually, I think just because of the massive interest in people going and paying their respects. Tuesday was officers only, mm-hmm. and then Thursday was for the general public. And so, yeah, just a lot of events this week. Actually, on Monday, I was there in Exeter near in the bandstand. The Exeter Police Department was collecting donations as cars drove by for the Arkell family, and I think they raised something in the order of $16,000 in 3 hours. And so I saw people dropping 50s and 100s into the tin, and it was just – it's amazing to see the outpouring of support for this family that's going through a tragedy that none of us can really imagine.
You know, very, very moving scene on all of those days. Gary, can I hear your thoughts on this week?
Well, I mean, it's always sad when we have a situation like this. I mean, it seems like lately it's been a little too often. I mean, we had the Greenland incident not that long ago. And I mean, it was just, it's very sad. And it's a real tribute. I mean, ironically, I guess, and not ironically, we had the memorial for the law enforcement this week as well. And it's always a reminder just what's at stake here.
Jeff, yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say that it really does hammer home the idea that, you know, these people, I mean, he was, Officer Arkell was, as you said, wasn't just a police officer, he was a part-time police officer. And he volunteered to help protect his community. And, you know, we're talking about people who are doing that for, in most cases, very little money. Pretty selfless people who put their lives on the line every day. And I'm talking about also as well as firefighters as well. A lot of people who do that are volunteers. And it makes you realize it takes special people to put themselves there as protectors of us and, you know, defending, you know, our ability to sit here and talk. Mm-hmm. And you realize how tight-knit that whole law enforcement community is when you see what Michael was talking about.
Absolutely. Norma, your thoughts?
Well, there were two things that really struck me and really made me choke up. One was that the field hockey team wore the number 87. That was his badge number. Yeah. And that the girls were playing an opponent this week who brought them flowers. The second thing was, and I know they do this as a tradition, but it's always so sad, they have the last call over the radio, and they call the badge, call the officer's name, and then say 10-2 out. And then at that point they say, you know, rest in peace, we'll stay with you. And I mean, that just always choked me up.
That was very moving. I actually heard that as well. Your thoughts about that, Michael?
Yeah, no, that was one of the more powerful moments of the whole ceremony. One of the anecdotes that I really enjoyed hearing about was how he taught himself a game of lacrosse just so he could coach his daughters on the team. I mean, if that doesn't tell you what kind of guy this guy was, you know, nothing. Well, I mean, he obviously put family first. He loved his daughters. He loved his family. But also the stories of the way he helped his community, not just in his role as the officer, as the part-time officer, animal control officer, but he was a carpenter. He did projects for people around town. Just, you know, just there were endless stories about the impact he had on that community, and he's obviously going to be missed.
Jeff, any long-term impact you see coming out of this, or what do you think the impact will be?
Well, it's interesting because this kind of does remind me of the case many years ago where a man named Carl Dragas went crazy and killed a bunch of people. And it did kind of raise the death penalty discussion again, and
which we will talk about.
Which we will talk about later.
Right.
But I do think that it does kind of put some kind of other spin on the idea. I mean, we know that the man who killed Officer Arkell is dead, but I still think it might change the dynamic of that debate as we go forward. I mean, we'll discuss this later, but I do think it does have an impact on that.
Now, Michael, related to the story, we've learned some more this week from investigators about, you know, what we know about what happened, what we may never know about what happened. Could you bring us up to date on that?
Yeah, there was a press conference Monday in Brentwood a week after the event took place, and you know, there were some things that they knew, some things that they say they may never know. One thing that they said they had determined was that the suspected gunman, Michael Nolan, did set fire to the house intentionally. The explosion was what they referred to as an unintended consequence of that, saying essentially that he had struck a gas line through his firing shots and that built up in the basement and then resulted in the explosion that we all saw. So that we know, they also found 6 guns, two assault rifles they found in the house. They've done a lot of interviews with the father, Walter Nolan, 87 years old. They say he's been cooperative, but essentially what it sounds like is that he genuinely can't recall what happened. They say he's essentially not in the right mental state to give them the answers they want. as far as why this happened, why his son would have opened fire on the officer, what led to the argument that brought Officer Arkell to the house in the first place, and they fear, and it sounded genuine, that they may never know. They may never get to
So it
answers.
Sounds like the combination of the father's memory, the fire burning things out, et cetera, that we just may not ever know exactly what happened.
Right. They say they'll still try, but they fear they may never know.
A very moving week, to be sure. One other kind of big story that I want to talk about before we have to take a break is the Wolfboro Police Commissioner resigning after this furor over a racial slur. And Gary, let me go to you and tell us what happened here. It sounds like he resigned.
Well, he did resign. I mean, he was overheard with a racial epithet, shall we say, referring to President Obama. And it all of a sudden blew up in the news. And about 100 people turned out to the commission meeting demanding he resign. I mean, you can say timing is everything, but, you know, Wolfboro prides itself on being the oldest summer resort in the country. And as we're coming into the tourist season, this isn't the kind of publicity that they wanted.
Norma?
Well, I think, you know, we all tend to sanitize what we are in public. And I suspect that you could find many, many small town officials who have said the same thing, some maybe in public and some overheard in private. I think what really made this case different wasn't so much what he said, that he said it in private, was that he refused to apologize when he was confronted with it. He said, no, I you know, basically hate him. And my lingering question, though, is, and I don't know that we'll ever know, since Wolfboro is primarily and New Hampshire is primarily a white state, white town, did it influence any actions that he took in his official capacity? And I don't know whether it did.
Jeff. Yeah, I have a similar thought to Norm on that. The other thing is that I keep thinking about this. He's been in this town for many years. He's been re-elected and re-elected to this position. And I can't believe – I mean, I live in a small town. I can't believe people didn't know already what his feelings were. And I can't believe that he wasn't in a situation in that very same diner where he's done the same kind of outburst. It just so happens this one woman was offended enough to write a letter to the selectman and say, you know, you got to do something about this guy. And it's really a disturbing thought to me that, you know, that he had been allowed to be doing this and serve in a capacity as an official of the town.
Well, we do need to take a break. Michael, I want to thank you for sitting in with us for this first portion of the show. We really appreciate it. And coming up, we're going to talk about a second go-round for the death penalty repeal in New Hampshire and the first new gas tax in over 20 years. Are you ready to pay for a bit more at the pump this summer? Let us know and keep it right here on The Exchange. It's the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. NHPR earned 4 Edward R. Murrow Awards for Outstanding Journalism this year, as well as a Gracie Award honoring excellent programming produced by women. You can hear the award-winning entries at our award-winning website, nhpr.org. More of the New Hampshire Friday News Roundup on The Exchange at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show. It's the national hour of the Friday News Roundup. Cloudy with some showers likely today, highs from upper 50s to around 60 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank, providing complete business banking services to small to medium-sized businesses in New Hampshire. Information at centrixbank.com. And from Lake Street Garden Center, specializing in plants grown for New England, celebrating 40 years with a new greenhouse, Lake Street Garden Center in Salem and at lakestreet.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange, and I'm Dean Spiliotis in for Laura Kanoy. Today on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're covering some of the stories that made headlines this week. You can call in at 1-800-892-6477. You can send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. My guests for the News Roundup today are Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review, Norma Love, State House reporter for the Associated Press, and Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader and the New Hampshire Sunday News. And folks, let's start with a couple of legislative items that have finally wound down in the legislature. The gas tax. It's been a long time in coming, Gary Reno, but it sounds like we're finally going to be paying a little bit more.
Well, yes, finally. After 1991 was the last time we raised the gas tax. And this time we had the governor signing the bill down in Salem over the I-93 expansion project, and we're going to see a little 4-cent increase in the gas tax beginning July 1. But whether we really see the 4 cents or not is another story, given that the gas is a commodity and it bounces up and down and all over the place. But
could you explain that a little bit more about you mean that we might not actually see it?
Well, I mean,
or state might not see it. The state will get its money.
The state will get its money, but the price of gasoline is a lot more dependent on the competition station to station and state to state than it is on what the gas tax is. All you have to do is look at the price of gas in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. They're almost always the same right around the border communities.
But the state will get its 4 cents regardless of the
$32 million.
So we may be paying a lot more or maybe a little bit.
But okay. 4 cents of it will be the gas tax. However much it goes up.
Jeff, implications of this.
First of all, I know that there was a very strong effort on the part, the support on the part of the people in the construction business in particular to get this thing passed, because they've been hoping for something like this for many years, really, because they feel that there's a need for, first of all, there's a need to, we have severe infrastructure needs, roads and bridges that are in desperate need of improvement and repair. You have the I-93 widening, which is a major economic they expect will be a major economic engine once it gets widened, and they think there'll be a lot of growth and development around it, which some people don't want to have, but that's pretty much a done deal.
There had been some argument that they would not be able to finish that without
absolutely. That was basically kind of held hostage as one of the, if you want to use that term, in these negotiations over the 4 cents tax. But another aspect to this that's interesting is that this is the same debate over raising the gas taxes going on in Washington, because Washington also finds itself short of money to fund all kinds of federal road projects. And there's a discussion right now going on whether they should increase the gas tax, because as New Hampshire has found out over the years, with greater fuel efficiency, cars that are more fuel efficient, they pay less in gas taxes because they're using less gasoline, and that's happening nationally as well. And there's a need to keep upkeep of the roads and bridges.
Norma, this was such a controversial issue for so long. We finally have it. Everyone seems kind of resigned to it. Does that mean that everybody kind of has a little political cover in November, or not necessarily?
Well, I think there'll be people who will go after Hassan for it, but I think Jim Roush, a Dairy Republican, he's retiring from the Senate, but this was something he really felt had to be done. He supported gambling to get money for road improvements, in particular, as Jeff said, Interstate 93's expansion. There are some permits, some environmental permits, that are going to run out if they don't get that highway finished soon, and then we'd have to go through a whole nother round of permitting process, which could delay, could cause cost increases. So there was that hanging over everyone. But political cover, as Gary said, this is a commodity, and your gas may go up. It always goes up Memorial Weekend, seems like, and then it'll drop down in the fall. Do we say that it's the gas tax going up for July 1, and then it drops down in September? Does it get credit for that? I doubt it.
Yeah. So is the hope that, because gas goes up and down, people will just sort of forget that there's 4 cents?
Well, the thing is that gas is such a volatile commodity, gasoline, that you can't tell. I mean, actually, I just saw today that the gasoline where I go went down 2 cents again this morning. So, I mean, how do you know when the tax takes effect?
It's going to be hard to tell. I mean, I think it's going to be hard to hang this on somebody politically, because I think most people know the roads are in tough shape.
Yeah, but I do have to say, though, you're talking about November, but I think in terms of September, in terms of the primaries there might be some fallout for some of the Republicans who voted for this. There's been talk about challenging various senators and others in GOP primaries because they supported taxes, and also because of Medicaid expansion. So there could be some, but I tend to doubt that. I think most people, by and large, think, well, we need to do something about it, and since we haven't raised this tax in 23 years, what the heck?
Norma, do you think this is going to be another 20 years before we see this again, or no?
I think it'll be a while. I think they spent some capital getting this passed, and the whole idea was that they would first 2 years, road improvements around the state. They had to have fixes all over the state to get buy-in from politicians. Otherwise, it would have been a Southern New Hampshire bill. And the second, after that, it's half of the money goes to pay off bonds that they need to finish I-93. And there's some money in the highway plan that's been sent to conference committee. So that's out there. And then supposedly this 4 cents goes away. I kind of wonder if it ever will go away. But it's really hard to get people to vote for a tax. And they did, although it's interesting, you were talking about the hybrid cars. They did send a bill to the governor, I believe, Gary, that taxes hybrid cars comparably.
There's one other thing I want to say is that you know, it's not that much money, but it still will put several people to work, which is not a bad thing in New Hampshire right now, considering the economy. And I mean, there's an economic impact to this that's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of us have to drive, so it sort of is what it is.
But to put it in perspective, I mean, if you have a very beat up road that everybody wants fixed, you know, it's going to cost $1 million a mile.
It's remarkable.
And, I mean, we only have $32 million from this. So, like, we're talking about 32 miles of really bad road that this would fix.
And I can name you more than 32 myself. So.
It's our Friday News Hampshire, News Roundup today on The Exchange. You can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. Oh, it's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. One more legislative item to talk about today, Norma Love. The death penalty came back up for a second vote this week in the Senate. What happened?
Well, I think that it lost. It lost on a voice vote yesterday. There was really no, appetite to re-debate it. Several weeks ago, we had a really emotional debate in the Senate. And then they tied 12-12, and they tied 12-12 again, and they tied 12-12 again. And every time they tried to do something, they tied 12-12. And so finally they put the bill, which had passed the House by about a 2-1 margin, on the table. And there were some people in the House who felt after a botched execution in Oklahoma that maybe they would sway someone. So they attached it again to a Senate bill and sent it back over. And Senator Bob O'Dell, who voted to repeal, doesn't like that kind of what he considers to be game playing with an issue of that magnitude. And he had told me last week he would not vote to accept the bill again. So it was pretty much
just on legislative principle.
Well, basically, he felt they'd had the debate. Everyone had had their say, and to keep pushing and pushing and pushing and attaching it to a bill. He had voted against an attempt to modify the original House bill that was sort of a belt and suspenders approach to. The governor had said she'd sign it if it did not influence in any way the death sentence of Michael Addison, who was convicted of killing a Manchester police officer. So they wanted to put in there a certain date. Anyone before this date, you would be liable to capital murder, and anyone after this date, you wouldn't. And he voted against that. He considered that also. Let's just vote on the pure issue.
Now, Jeff—
As opposed to casino gambling, but we'll get into that
one. Reminded me of casino gambling. Jeff, my understanding was that this came back up in part because of the botched execution in Oklahoma, but now the Stephen R. Kell shooting seems to have counterweighed that a bit.
I think that. I mean, if you think about how difficult this issue is, and the closest to the vote in the Senate, as Norma said, you know, things like the killing of a police officer have a very strong effect on especially on elected officials, and I can see that potentially in a year when this will come up again, that you know there might be a different kind of dynamic in the debate. The botched execution is something else that affects the dynamic of a debate, but. The murder of a police officer also carries a lot of weight, you know, especially a New Hampshire police officer, you know, who obviously, as Michael was describing, just was a regular guy doing his job.
Gary, your thought on the future of this? Are we going to see it again next session?
Well, I'm sure we are. I mean, they had more support, the opponents for the people for I want the appeal had more support in the House than they've ever had before. I think they think that they have the momentum going their way. But, I mean, we're going to have a whole different group of people in the legislature next year. And how that plays out is going to depend on who gets elected.
Yeah. Seems like we'll have to get a read on the legislature and then think about it. Yeah, Norma, quick.
Well, just very quickly, I think if you look back, what the last time legislature passed a bill to repeal the death penalty was in 2000, and Governor Gene Shaheen vetoed it. And then we had some attempts after that didn't get as far. So it kind of comes and goes. And yes, as Gary pointed out, it's who's in the legislature, but it's also the times. Things have to kind of happen in a certain time.
Right. It's sort of the mood and the timing is very important. A couple political stories to talk about today, one local, one national, and one international, but all with connections to New Hampshire. And Jeff, let me start with you. Matt Maurer, the New Hampshire Republican Party's executive director, spent about 5 hours down in New Jersey testifying this week. What was that all about?
Well, Mr. Maurer was working for Governor Chris Christie's at the time, who's the governor of New Jersey, who is this whole – the hearings involved that so-called Bridgegate scandal, which involved the closing of several lanes in Fort Lee, New Jersey, that to go on – to enter the George Washington Bridge. And it caused 4 days of massive traffic jams, and I know what I can imagine how massive they were because I used to live down there, and they were miles and miles, and it just frustrated and angered many, many people down there. It turns out that apparently, the governor's office, people in the governor's office took responsibility for or have responsibility for ordering the closing of the lanes, and the allegation was it was involved political retribution to the mayor of Fort Lee, New Jersey, for refusing to endorse Governor Christie, even though the mayor is a Democrat and the governor is a Republican. Well, Mr. Maurer was asked to testify to say what his role was, because he apparently kept this – he was involved in keeping relations –
He was the endorsement solicitor,
basically. Yeah, he was involved in keeping relations with various – with some a list of 100 communities in New Jersey or whatever. And he was – the interesting thing about Mr. Maurer in terms of the New Jersey political angle is – that apparently he had told the Christie people very early in 2013, after talking with the mayor, Mayor Sokolich. Mayor Sokolich said, there's just no way I'm going to endorse Governor Christie, basically for his own personal reasons, economic reasons, financial reasons. I just can't afford to, I just can't do it. I'm in a Democratic town. I can't do it. And he supposedly notified Christie's office, but the governor, many, many months later, said, I had never heard about this. I had no idea. I didn't know anything. This guy wasn't on my radar screen, but there were people in his office who were making outreach to the mayor. So, I mean, it's an interesting political story, because the bottom line is that Governor Christie still wants to run for president of the United States, and it's looking less and less likely at this point that he's going to have any traction down in New Jersey, because people are getting pretty angry about it again.
Gary, your thoughts on kind of the New Hampshire implications? I know Jennifer Horn has stood by Matt Maurer. What about that? What about Chris Christie in New Hampshire?
Well, I mean, I think even more important than maybe Matt Maurer and Christie is the fact that they have this horrendous deficit right now in New Jersey.
Very good point.
Which makes it probably even less likely that he'll come out as a nice smelling presidential candidate. But in New Hampshire, Matt Maurer has a certain brought something to the Republican Party that the Democrats have sort of seized on, which is he's very aggressive. And there's some very aggressive things coming out of there, press releases and Twitter and all that sort of thing. But she certainly, Jennifer Horn certainly has stood right behind Matt and said nothing that's going to change as far as she's concerned. Interestingly enough, there's also another person who was involved in this, who was in Christie's office, Colin Reed, who is now the campaign manager for Scott Brown, who's running for U.S. Senate. So he's also going to have to go down, and he's been subpoenaed, and so he's going to have to testify.
So this will to be continued. One other political story this week. It's another Republican story. Gubernatorial candidate Walt Havenstein was out on the campaign trail this week, and he made a little bit of news with a couple of his comments. Jeff, what did the candidate have to say?
Well, first of all, I guess he was asked about this proposed constitutional amendment to support same-sex equality. What was that? I mean, basically, it's an amendment that says you can't discriminate on base of
sexual orientation. Right.
And he said to a reporter that he would veto that constitutional amendment, which apparently would be a unique act in New Hampshire history,
governor, right.
Because a governor can't do that. Right. So he showed a little lack of understanding there. But apparently, in the same interview, he said some very disparaging things about our current Commissioner of Resources and Economic Development, Jeff Rose, which basically said that he had worked at BAE Systems for many years, very well known.
Walt Havenstein was the CEO, right?
Yes, he was very well known. And actually, when he was appointed by Governor Hassan, they said, "Well, what are you doing? You're appointing this Republican and all this stuff. People with Republican ties, person with Republican ties." But he said some very disparaging thing about Commissioner Rose, who wisely has not commented on anything. But it just it made you realize that he's, you know, this is, you know, you really need to be ready for prime time in running for office, and he's making these really rookie mistakes. I don't even know if they're rookie mistakes; they're amateur mistakes. And he's I think his staff is realizing that he needs to have a little bit more prepping on how to talk with people.
Norma, your reaction to this and the Republican race for governor more generally.
Well, I think that I think the Republicans wanted and they recruited Havenstein in a way. They didn't think they had a strong enough candidate in Andrew Hemingway. And so what now I wonder is who's advising him, because he's not being he's not, as Jeff said, he's not coming out of the box really, really working the game the way they thought he would. I mean, he's got a lot of money. He can pay his way. But can he come out and make a statement that says, me, not her, me, not a Hemingway? And right now he's stumbling. And it's early. I mean, there's plenty of time to recover. But the polls are not showing that Hassan is any trouble.
Any real concern.
And as a first-time term governor, the only governor, first term in recent memory that we haven't reelected is Craig Benson. And there was a lot of things going on when he was governor and that had upset his own party. So Hassan hasn't done that. So I think that he's got a ways to go, more than just having money.
Gary?
Well, I think, too, as Norma said, he's got some very good people advising him. And, I mean, why he's out there saying this and they haven't sort of prepped him a little better is kind of amazing, I think.
Yeah, one other thing I wanted to say was that, you know, both political parties have an infatuation with getting people they think are, you know, these people with money, self-funded candidates or nearly self-funded candidates. And I think the money blinds them to the ability of a person to be a candidate, because it takes a special ability to be a successful candidate, especially for a high political office.
Well, and it seems like Havenstein's big selling point is that he's a CEO, and he's sort of that's kind of the CEO model of governance, which doesn't always translate.
Well, as Norma referred, we had a CEO governor. Right. We had Governor Lynch was a CEO model, but before him we had another CEO governor who was not a success. And, so, you know, you're rolling the dice on that.
And if we remember, Craig Benson also was basically self-funding his campaign.
Yes, that's,
and, I mean, when you're self-funding your campaign, sometimes your attitude's a little different than if you're out there raising
absolutely,
money.
Absolutely.
There's a difference, though, I think, when you're a CEO than when you're governor. And Lynch understood that very well. And I don't think Craig Benson understood it quite as well, and that's what caused him some friction.
Well, we're going to continue to watch Mr. Havenstein closely on the campaign trail. We do need to take one more break, but after the break, we'll talk about the state Supreme Court preparing to weigh in on public pensions and so-called double dipping. What do you think about the limits of public employment after public retirement? That's coming up next, so keep it right here for the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. President Obama defends embattled VA Secretary Eric Shinseki, and establishment Republicans declare victory in Tuesday's primaries. Then, China and Russia sign a $400 billion natural gas deal. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Antioch University New England's new certificate in counseling specifically focused on returned military personnel to help those who served us, antiochne.edu. And Healthy at Home offering New Hampshire residents licensed medical care, Alzheimer's assistance, transportation, and household support, all in the comfort of home. HealthyAtHome.org. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange, and I'm Dean Spiliotis. Monday on The Exchange, it's our earlier conversation with Dartmouth veterans of the Vietnam War. But today it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and you can join us by calling in at 1-800-892-6477 or send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Twitter at @NHPRExchange. And my guests today for the News Roundup are Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review, Norman Love, State House reporter for the Associated Press, and Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader. And folks, one more political story I want to talk about, and this has an international component to it. And Gary, Mayor Randall, let me go to you. We've heard this frightening case involving a pregnant Sudanese physician who's married to a Manchester man, and several members of our congressional delegation are now involved in the story to try to get, I guess, asylum for this woman. And it's getting national and international attention.
It is. Maryam Ishag, who is a physician, as you said, and she has a two-year-old son with her, and she's being held in a Sudanese prison. And she's being sentenced. She's been sentenced to death by hanging because she won't renounce her Christianity. She has her husband, who is Daniel Wani, is a Manchester resident and a United States resident. He was living in Manchester. Now he's over in Sudan trying to free his wife, and she is supposedly going to be able to have her baby and nurse a baby for 2 years before her sentence would kick in. But we have Senator Ayotte and the rest of the congressional delegation, Carol Shea Porter, checking in, trying to pressure the United States to offer asylum to this woman.
And this is sort of a fairly complex story.
It's very confusing because it's hard to tell
that she may be in jail for 2 years to have her child, and then they'll deal with her after that. It's very complicated. It's a very sort of scary, potentially tragic story.
It's very disturbing. Yeah. It's very disturbing. It's one of these things that happens where you don't even there's such a different the culture clash is just so obvious and so it makes you can't even wrap your head around what's going on over there.
Yeah, it is pretty remarkable. We're going to continue to monitor it, and it was interesting to learn that Manchester connection. We have an email and a phone call I want to get to here. John in Moultonboro writes in, this is pertaining to the gas tax, and he says, we have 560,000 people estimated to be in New Hampshire this weekend for Memorial Day. The governor has decided to raise the gas tax and make visitors and residents alike pay 4 more cents. And John asked, why not increase the toll on Route 93 to pay for the improvements? And in the same vein, to continue the discussion of the gas tax, JP is joining us from Concord. JP, welcome to The Exchange.
Thanks for having me. How are you guys today?
Good. What's your question, sir?
My question is kind of a question and a comment. The figure $32 million has been thrown around as the intake from the 4 cents gas tax. I'm not really sure where this number came from, and maybe you guys can enlighten me, but I'm curious to know, having done a little bit of research, based upon the registered vehicles in the state, diesel, gas, all plates, if my math, and I could be completely wrong here, basically accounts for 4 cents times the number of vehicles times one fill up a week, which is relatively 12 gallons, which gives you that $32 million. Now, I drive a lot more than one fill up a week, and I'm sure a lot of residents in the state do, not to mention the commercial trucking industry and all that. So I'm wondering if you could just tell us a little bit more, if anybody on the panel happens to know about what where those numbers come from.
Anybody want to speak to the numbers or more general? We also have the email about tolls.
This is Norma. I don't recall exactly how the Department of Transportation calculated it. I think they probably did it more along the lines of what they're getting now out of the 18 cents. But I think that one of the reasons that the people bring up the issue of the toll, and why not a toll? When you have a toll, you have diversion, and then you have more people on your local roads causing tie-ups and infrastructure problems for them, and the money that flows to the local communities out of the gas tax, there's 12% of it, not all of it. And that's one of the reasons that we're in the problem we're in statewide. There just hasn't been enough money to do it all. There's some fixes they'd like to do on some of the turnpikes, which are revenue dependent upon the tolls, but that would mean raising those tolls even more to do that. So some of those things have been postponed. So it's a conundrum. Where do you start?
Gary, raise the tolls?
Basically, there are two separate systems in the state. I mean, one is the turnpike system, which is funded by the tolls. And then you have the rest of the state highway system, which is basically funded through the gas tax and auto registrations. So, I mean, that you can't really mess around with the funds because of various federal issues and so on,
and also as far as Interstate 93 is, that's a federal highway, and we couldn't put a toll on there unless we had some kind of a permission from the federal government, which I doubt would be forthcoming. I'm not sure about that.
JP, thanks for that call. And John, thanks for the email. One issue that has popped up before the state Supreme Court is it's an interesting one with, I think, potentially far-reaching consequences for public employees collecting their pensions. This is the so-called issue of double dipping. And let me turn to you, Jeff. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on here before the Supreme Court?
Well, basically, it's an issue that's been coming up for a while now. It's about public employees who are retired, who receive a pension, and then they go back and get another public job and get that salary. And under a state law that was passed, I believe, in 2012, was it, Norma? Is that what, Gary?
It was in the last couple of years.
Yeah. They said you only can work part-time at a public job if you want to keep collecting your pension, your public pension. And what's happened is that we have a few people who are taking this to the Supreme Court saying, well, that's not fair to us because we just want to, you know, work. They're saying it's unconstitutional to have this, what they say is an arbitrary number. It's 32 hours per week. Anything over 32 hours is considered full time under this law. So they're suing basically to say that they shouldn't be denied the pension that they worked for in their previous job, and as well as having any other job that they want to have afterwards.
Yeah, Norma.
Well, I was there when they passed this and debated it and negotiated it, and there are a couple issues here. The pension system isn't fully funded. So the whole reason for this and some other changes was how do we shore up the pension system? And by allowing people to work and fill jobs that otherwise they would be paying into that system, it shrinks the pool of people who are helping fund it. And that was one argument. Obviously, the other argument was if I go back and take a public job and exactly what they're arguing in court, why shouldn't I be allowed to do that? So, you know, you could look at both sides of it, but the fact of the matter is that the whole impetus behind this was to shore up a pension system that is only, I think, 56% funded.
Yeah, it is an issue that's really just weighing over the legislature over the last several years and will continue to be weighing over it. This whole the idea of the retirement system, they've been trying to fix it, and this was kind of one little fix, trying to say, well, you know, this is one way of saving some money, but, you know, we'll see what the court says about it.
Yeah, and it's a bigger issue than it might seem to be, because you have – it's been going on for a long time where people would retire. They put their 20 years in. They retire at full retirement benefits. And then they go out and they supposedly work part-time. They didn't really put the exact number of hours on it until recently. And so anybody was going out there, some people who retired, and they were taking police chief jobs and saying they were part-time.
More than 32 hours. Yeah. Which
even though they weren't, and weren't paying into the system. I mean, when you're drawing on the system and nobody's putting into it, you're basically taking a double dip on it, yeah, if you will.
Well, this is something I think we're going to be following. I know a lot of states deal with big public pension issues, so we'll see what the Supreme Court decides in the state. We transitioning into summer now. Memorial Day weekend is ahead of us. We had a harsh winter, to be sure. And Jeff Feingold, the North Country is still dealing with some flooding issues, and Governor Hassan has stepped in here.
Yeah, there was some serious flooding in April up north in Columbia and areas around there. And the governor had got the federal government to declare that area a disaster area, which makes them eligible for federal loans and disaster assistance. You know, it was a brutal winter. Well, maybe not. It was a regular winter. I have to correct myself, but we haven't had a regular winter in a long time, so that's why it felt so brutal.
It was brutal to you, Jeff.
That's right. I'm from Brooklyn.
Well, you have a lot of snow, and if it warms up quickly, it's all got to go.
No, exactly. There was a lot of snow. There's a lot of precipitation, and this is what happens with it. It's, you know, this is what happens in New England, northern New England in particular.
Yeah. I think it draws attention to the subject we were on a few minutes ago about infrastructure and the needs. I mean, this kind of flooding can take out a bridge, and hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions, to replace some of these bridges. Think about where you've got one bridge to get around town and it's gone. Now, how do you get there? And that's one of the problems that has faced the state.
Is dealing with the
closed bridges. The state can go to a community and say, this bridge no longer meets our standards. It's up to the community to close it. It's their bridge, their liability. And there has been in recent years a few towns that have fixed the bridges on the property tax as opposed to waiting to be on that list to get money from the state.
Yeah, and speaking of lists, I mean, we have a huge number of bridges that are on the so-called red list that are either dangerous or getting in that state. And, you know, they're all over the state, and it's something to really keep an eye on. Yeah.
Well, we will. We'll see if the federal government honors the request by Governor Hassan. This next story is an interesting story. Norman Love, apparently New Hampshire has a wild or feral pig, also known as wild boar, problem. Can you say a little bit about that?
Well, I'm very familiar with wild pigs. My mother left me some pasture land in Texas, which is overrun with them, and they hunt them all the time. They're very destructive. I wasn't aware that they were in New Hampshire, and they've asked the public's help in spotting them so they can get a handle on where the populations are. But these pigs, or boars, or whatever you want to call them, can take their snout and dig up a crop, dig up a fence, dig up whatever, your garden. They're very destructive. They get into what they call wallows to cool themselves off, and you can see it. It's very apparent. It looks like, you know, somebody's just rolled around in the muck, or they created muck to roll around
in.
And
they don't really have predators in New Hampshire.
Not really. You can't hunt them under our laws unless they're considered an escaped private land. Mm-hmm. So you would have to have the landowner's permission to go after them. I know people in Texas who hunt them and eat them, but apparently they also can have trichinosis and other issues. So I don't know if I'd want to eat them.
Help yourself.
I recall a reality show on TV at one point about hunters of these wild boars.
Yeah, there's several of them up in the Newport area where there's a big private hunting preserve up there called Corbin Park,
right.
And occasionally they do escape. And actually, I think, remember, not too long ago, it caused a really terrible accident on I-89. This wild boar came out of nowhere while this car was driving
down
there.
And they can be pretty big, hundreds of pounds.
Yes,
right?
And
you can see dozens of them crossing the highways in Texas. I mean, it's just like a little train of them.
Well, and so it's a fascinating story. It would be interesting to see how they deal with it. It sounds like it's actually a pretty serious problem. Mm. But our final story for today, and Gary Reno, not intentionally saving this for you, but perhaps you can educate us. We learned this week that New Hampshire is a pretty groovy place to live. It's the third best place, according to a real estate website, to be a hippie in the United States.
But Vermont and Maine are better than New Hampshire. So.
Well, you knew Vermont was going to be ahead of us. I just didn't know who the other state was.
What is to me was so interesting is how they judged which states were the most welcoming to hippies. They took the number of communes, the number of co-ops, and stores selling hemp products, tie-dye products, and then the Facebook users who like the Grateful Dead, fish, cannabis, tie-dye, peace, Bob Dylan of all people, and LSD. So that's how we decided that we're going to be third in line here.
It sounds like a serious social science statistical analysis.
Actually, when you go by that measure, I mean, the co-op up in Hanover, you know, that must be just inundated with hippies. You know, all those doctors and professors at Dartmouth didn't realize that.
So you think this will be a boon for tourism in New Hampshire?
I don't know. All I could think of was when I was at Berkeley. I went to Berkeley, University of California, and in the middle of the hippies and, you know, tie-dye and everything. And I never thought of New Hampshire, libertarian state that it is, as being hippie. I suppose there are some pockets, but, you know, I don't think of someone who likes granola as a hippie.
Yeah,
well, there were several communes in New Hampshire back in the day, and there's a core. I mean, you know, it's not, you know, it's, you don't think of it as much as Vermont,
right.
But
and there still is a pretty large commune down in Barrington.
Yeah.
Interesting. We're going to be watching this
story. Still holding on.
Still holding on.
We'll look to see if there's a sudden influx of hippies, and sort of noting the age distribution on the panel. It sort of is the sweet spot for a hippie nation here. We've come to that point in the show where I want to ask you all, what are you going to be looking at next week? The legislature is winding down. Norma, what are you going to be focused on?
Well, they're going to have the sprint of sprints Tuesday through Friday by 4 o'clock. They have to solve all of their problems on their bills that they haven't solved. And the primary one among them is the tax on hospitals that two judges have ruled is unconstitutional. The governor's negotiating. The House and Senate leaders are negotiating. But so far, no deal.
Gary.
And the same thing. I mean, we were at the Committee of Conference time, which is where they try to resolve all the differences between the House and Senate versions of bills. By far, the biggest bill is the Medicaid enhancement tax.
Do you have any insight on sort of how that is shaping up? Is it going to be a contentious conference?
I think it will be contentious. But there was talk yesterday that when Governor Haas was presenting her spending freeze, she brought up the possibility of a special session in the summer. And which point
another special session like the one we had last fall. Right?
Yep. And this one would deal with the finances. And then Senate President Chuck Moore says, well, the only reason I'm coming back is for the MET, not for this revenue problem. So we all sat there going, oh, no.
Flashback.
Obviously, they're not that close. So we wouldn't be coming talking about a special session to deal with the MET.
And the Senate killed off its version of the bill. There were two versions out there. And so they're the ones who get to call all the meetings.
Get to call the shots. That's right. Jeff?
We'll be working on a pretty big piece on misclassification of workers, which is something that's pretty prevalent in the construction industry, where allows employers to not have to pay workers' comp and everything by declaring an employee an independent contractor. And it's an issue that's been coming to the fore lately.
And why is that so? By declaring someone an independent contractor,
they don't have to pay for workers' comp, they don't have to pay benefits, they don't have to pay unemployment, all the taxes, and that goes on the employee. Certain contractors have been doing that, but others that are on the up and up, let's say, are saying that's not a level playing field because they are paying their employees the way they're supposed to be.
Wow, it's really interesting. Well, we are out of time, but I know we're going to continue to talk about a lot of these stories in the coming week. I hope you all have a very good Memorial Day weekend. I'd like to thank all of my guests this morning. Jeff Feingold, editor of the New Hampshire Business Review. Jeff, thanks for joining us.
Great for being here. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure thing. Norma Love, senior State House reporter for the Associated Press. Norma, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks, Dean. You too.
And Gary Reno, State House reporter for the Union Leader and the New Hampshire Sunday News. Gary, thanks for joining us once again.
Oh, you're welcome, Dean.
And my thanks to NHPR reporter Michael Brindley for joining us earlier in the show to talk about Stephen R. Kell. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is James Pouliot. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Dean Spiliotis from Southern New Hampshire University, sitting in for Laura Canoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, we begin with our earlier conversation with Vietnam War veterans from Dartmouth's class of 1964, whose stories are collected in a new book. Next, the millennial generation, its mindset, impact on the workplace, and how it's viewed by others. And later, the head of New England's power grid about the challenges of meeting the region's energy needs. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show is next at 10 on New Hampshire Public Radio, where support comes from you, our listeners, and from Verekai from Cirque du Soleil, a world of endless possibilities coming to Manchester. Verekai opens June 25th at Verizon Wireless Arena. Tickets at Ticketmaster.com. And from Centrix Bank, see beyond with Centrix Bank. Customized business banking for businesses, professionals, municipalities, and not-for-profit organizations. Online at CentrixBank.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. In another cabinet shuffle, President Obama this afternoon plans to nominate San Antonio Mayor Julian Castro for housing secretary. He will replace Sean Donovan, who's expected to take over the White House budget office. The president pledges to get to the bottom of problems at VA.